The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
Welcome to 100 Proof. I am not Kevin Rose. I am not Derek. This is Eli Scheinman, head of art at Proof. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a great show today. Welcome, Derek. You know him. Say what up.
What's going on, everybody? Excited to be here. We've got an action-packed 100 Proof with Eli sitting in the hot seat and a killer crew with us today. We can keep going around the horn.
Yeah, Derek, so you've got this hat that's now making it into every show. We'll come back to that later. Maybe those are the good guys at Transient that we love and OHDGB. Of course, we also have Amanda holding it down on the community side. What's up, Amanda?
GM. It. Happy to be here. That's it. No, good happy. I'm happy. You. We're chilling. I'm manning Twitter and Discord and YouTube comments. If you have anything to say, just shoot me that. Yeah, let's go.
That's right. No FUD allowed. Everything else, real questions, let's go. And we are super grateful and honored to have the man, the myth, the legend in black, Pixel Pete,
let's
to help us bring down the big auction yesterday. Let's go. Thank you so much, Pete.
Yeah, thrilled to be here. Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be on the show and be on the other end for once.
This is going to be a lot of fun. And Pete, he put up with our half an hour or so of prep as he watched us set up less elegantly than he probably expected. So appreciate it, Pete. Okay, a quick reminder.
It was very
to stay updated with all of our shows, all of our content, everything from Sam, NFT Stats, all of our artist spotlights, follow Proof Podcasts on Twitter, get all of the content there. And then today we're also simulcasting, and what an old school word, but we're simulcasting this show on Twitter natively and YouTube. So hop into either of those and join the conversation. Amanda, as she said, she's manning the boards over there. We've got a great show. We're going to spend a lot of time breaking down the auction yesterday, talk about the big goose sale, what that means for the space. We'll talk about Pete's experience with that work in particular, pretty crazy origin story. And then at the very end of the show, we'll go to our James Jean studio tour, which I cannot wait to share with you. James is, as many of you know, an amazing illustrator, a Grails 2 artist. And he took us into his studio. We got the full walkthrough. He took us through some of his recent work, some of the very early work of his. So excited for that to kick off at the end. But let me kick it over to you, Amanda. We had a big announcement yesterday. Tell us what we talked about and ultimately what people can expect.
Even before that, though, I want to just plug the Mythic Chronicles. I feel like you forgot that, and that I think is probably at least like the second or third most important thing of what people are here for, is to watch Justin and his crew have a little fun with Mythic. So we're going to have that even before the James Jean studio visit. So just a little plug for that, because I know a lot of people are waiting for that. But yesterday, we did make a big announcement. It was the Proof Foundry. We announced it coming this summer. We are going to have an actual IRL space here in downtown Los Angeles at the Row, the Skylight Row here in LA. This is going to be our hub for like 6 months here in Los Angeles for us to connect with our community, for us to connect with other artists, and for them to showcase their work. We're going to be, this is going to be this hub for all of our future art releases and exhibitions. We're going to have an artist residency program. We're going to have some live podcasts there. We're going to have meetups. We really want to use this space in a myriad of different things and really try to make a huge impact for the next 6 months. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So without further ado, let's check out that video.
What united Kevin and I before we called it Proof was our love of art. What the blockchain enabled for me was the first time I could ever be a patron of somebody I believed in and said, I love what you're creating. And I get that this isn't hosted in the Guggenheim. I get that this isn't the MoMA at this point. An art collector is somebody that you hire somebody to tell you what art you can put in your one of four houses. And now, whether you knew it or not, because maybe you never consider yourself an art collector, you're owning something that feels like I'm a part of not only your journey, but now it's mine to be able to hold on to. That means everything to me. And that changed the game and my understanding of digital collectibles in a very big way. What I hope that Proof continues to build is a great relationship to support artists, a great community to come by and to continue to be a part of that, to be patrons. We built a great ecosystem of access, opportunity for everybody who's a part of it. And I think we build a very big family that cares deeply about our impact on this world and why art matters. And honestly, there's going to be fun experiences. There's going to be gamified experiences. There's going to be fun things to do if you're not yet sold on it, but you're like, I don't know. I'm kind of art curious, but I don't really get how all those are. That's okay. We'll work with you on that. But I really believe in telling these stories and sharing in this journey, it's an open road.
That was an amazing video. Shout out Justin. I love how Mao just clicked a random video of Justin just waxing poetically, and it just fit perfectly for this video. That's just Justin. That's just straight from his core, and I love that. We had a lot of really amazing community response from that. So that was a really fun day here on the team to just really see everyone really trying to put all of these little pieces together, as we are too, and really seeing what we're doing here in the space. And I just love that. So shout out Web3Believer91, who says he's super impressed with what Kevin and the Proof team are doing with the Foundry. He believes that Proof and will be a whole ecosystem for digital art with Moonbirds and Proof of Podcasts only being the very beginning. He's super bullish on that, and I love that. Shout out EZAGNBA, who says this is really dope. This is an amazing use case. I know. This is an amazing use case of Proof's money to support artists in the space and future artists. He loves to see it. Hashtag no more fanny packs. If you're going, the more times you mention the fanny packs, the more I really, really want to have that happen. So I'm pulling for an IRL merch shop of just all the different fanny packs. We've got Patagonia fanny packs. We're going to do more Cotopaxis. We're going to do it all. It's just going to be a whole wall of fanny packs just for you guys. We got Nick.eth, who I really love. He's a Proof Collective holder and a Moonbird, who's just incredible support of us. And I just want to shout you out. He says, here comes a summer of NFT events, collabs, and magic. What a bullish move. I bet the results of this are going to be next level. So shout out to you. And then one of our favorites, JackGK.eth. He says he's been waiting for a team to do this. I think it's incredibly bullish. The team plus art and events, this is where magic happens. And it's true. This is one of the things that we do really, really well. And so we're just so happy to kick this off in Los Angeles. If this goes well after the 6 months, who knows where we could end up. So stay tuned for more information. The first event that we're going to have there is a Mythic celebration, and we'll be announcing that in the next couple weeks. So look out for that. Back to you, Eli.
Yeah, 100%. I'm super excited. And we're going to do some of these from the space. We'll do some live 100 proof episodes.
Yes.
Among the other things that we'll do there, artist programming, live exhibitions. I am super excited. Pete, we got to get you out here. And Derek, I know you'll be around. So excited to spend some time together in that space with the whole community, really. Should be great. But let's jump into the big news of the week, the auction yesterday. And before we kick into, and there's like so many layers of this that we could unpack, I want to give kudos to Michael and the team at Sotheby's. I think it's easy for the auction house to be a bit of a punching bag generally in the art world. But the way that they've shown up for the generative art community, for tokenized art, for the artists in the show in terms of honoring royalties when that's not something they had to do, despite them using the Grail's name, joking aside, huge kudos to Michael and the team there. I thought they did a great job. But
Eli's so petty. Eli's so petty. I love that he had to just
throw that little dig
in there. You had to do it.
No. Everything's a Grail these days. That's no, true. Pete, you know, we thought it would be super fun to have you on the show. You know, you have this, of course, amazing history with the Goose and with that work. Maybe just as some context, can you tell people a little bit about that origin story of that work and your collecting?
Yeah, of course. Thanks again for having me, and super excited about the Foundry and to visit it myself. But yeah, you know, Ringers was like my first, it was the first time that like generative art sort of clicked for me. I had sort of been around since the beginning because of my relationship with Eric. But initially on the first look of Ringers, it was the thing that I was like most excited about having a chance to mint, you know, and I was there in those early days minting, and it was just super exciting. So in the Discord, Dave had mentioned or he had reacted to someone posting the Goose with the goose emoji, and that was sort of the first note of the Goose being a goose. And Dimitri sort of like really expressed how much he liked it right away. It really was like appealing to me immediately as something that stood out from the collection. And it went on auction by the original minter like 2 days after the mint, and I was lucky enough to win that auction somehow, and was just like honored to sort of be a steward of it. It, you know, through that time I became close with Dimitri, and it was just really special. And you know, eventually I had ordered a print of it, and I posted some photos of the print. I think 6529 posted a tweet about this the other day, but I posted a photo of it, and I heard, no, Dimitri posted that tweet. And a few days later, like a month later, I had a couple interesting bids in my DMs, which started this like wild roller coaster, and eventually led to the purchase through VVD on behalf of 3AC. And it just really like, I mean, obviously that was like a moment that spurred my ability to collect at a greater scale than I've ever been able to collect for. And, it really like was the impetus for me, recognizing the value in being like a steward for other artists, you know, and like an early collector of other artists and sort of an advocate for artists. And I've just sort of like ridden that since. And it was just like a really special moment in my life. And it's been fun to watch this this next phase of it going to the other bidder in that scenario way back when.
And just quickly,
go ahead, Eli.
Before we jump ahead, it's on Twitter somewhere. The co-founder of Math Castles, 113, was part of this origin story because they were also bidding for the Goose, I think against you, right, Pete? And you ultimately outbid them by something like 0.1. But we're talking like the original buy price for you guys was like 1.something ETH, right? This is going way back, or a couple ETH at most.
Yeah.
So it's fun to have him in that origin story too.
Yeah, in those, I mean, I can't remember, the mint was like 0.35 or something. It was quite low. But then on the secondary market, things were like in the 1 to 2 range. And yeah, it had gone on auction, and Dimitri posted that the goose was on auction. And back then, OpenSea had a really strange auction format where you can like place bids, and the seller could just sort of click accept at any moment. So I surpassed 113's bid by this low amount because it was like all I had in my wallet, and said, well, there goes my shot in the Discord. And literally within the hour, Dimitri pings me and he says, you won the Goose. I can't believe it. I'm so happy for you. And somehow this person had like accepted the bid and sort of, altered my life. But 113 has been just like so incredibly gracious throughout this whole time, and has expressed that what I was able to help foster through the Goose ownership, I think, is something that they don't know that they'd be able to do, although, you know, who knows. But it's really nice to have that like sort of positive relationship back and forth between us after all this time.
It's such a interesting look and like symbol for, I think, what has made the Art Blocks community kind of like a special place for people to learn and get enthusiastic about work, and the, you know, the two-way conversation between you and Dimitri, but then other collectors. And it's just like that story, I think, is very emblematic of, I think, why generative art and long form generative art has spurred like this amazing grassroots community around it. I think before we jump to the auction, I know folks who are looking at kind of the eye popping numbers that are happening around the whole day yesterday are kind of wondering why the goose in particular stood out kind of as an object within this greater generative collection. So I know it sounded like, you know, Dimitri and Dave and you yourself and others in the early Art Blocks community had kind of gravitated towards this thing, but maybe you can just speak to why the goose was interesting, maybe as like this unintentional figurative character that stood out in this otherwise, you know, sanitized exercise and kind of wrapping strings around pegs, and just like kind of why you think this thing has broken out from a narrative perspective.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in those early days, I think it stood out to me just because it was, you know, graphically really unique, and it sort of just, it stood out when you're looking at the whole as something, at something quite unique and, you know, sort of these emergent properties that aren't tied to rarities and things like that. That was the first sort of sentiment of that, of us starting to have that conversation, I think, in even those early days, is what is statistical rarity versus just these sort of emergent qualities that have like a life of their own that can be carried through this like community connection, which is like something that's so amazing about this space. And I think that as time went on and that became sort of memeified in this like really wonderful, you know, this art is born from the internet, from computing, and there's like something really endearing about this like memification that happens in a natural way, like through a sense of community. And you just find that like your bond to this thing, whether you own it or not, I think like just like strengthens. And yeah, and it just creates this life of its own that I think is what has been touched upon most recently in 6529's tweet about their ultimate purchase of the goose and what it means to he and their team. But yeah, it's just something really special. And I think we've all sort of discovered it throughout our time in this space, that there's this other quality to certain things that sort of lifts it above the rest and makes it sort of stand out on its own.
Does anyone know who called it the goose? Who named it that?
It was Dave, right?
Yeah, it Dave? Yeah, it was Dave.
Who?
Yeah. Dave in the Discord, D-D-A-A-V-V-E-E. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's a screenshot somewhere.
Like, talk. Cool.
Yeah, I was trying to find the screenshot as you guys were talking. It's out there somewhere. So we'll maybe track it down. But you know, this has been top of mind for me because, you know, there's this conversation around curated outputs versus the randomness that occurs through the minting process, and what collectors in different segments maybe do or don't desire. But setting that aside for a moment, let's focus back on the auction. Maybe Derek, I'll kick it over to you. Were there any elements of the auction outside of the goose maybe that really caught your eye?
Yeah, I think the first thing I'll say is, you know, I think kudos to Michael again for putting on such an amazing, amazing exhibition and auction. And I think storytelling the work that's happening in our space in a way that I felt was respectful, but then also, you know, even just the day before, I remember Michael was retweeting art from other artists in the Web3 space that were kind of, to Pete's point, you know, memifying the goose and maybe their own artistic style. And so there was this very fun and playful intersection between the traditional, you know, auction process that feels a little bit, you know, exclusive with kind of the networking and the meme culture and the memification and the crypto nativeness of our own space. That I thought was really interesting and just like threaded the needle in a way that I thought was very, very cool for the first time that I had really seen this. I think the second thing was, you know, there was a lot of work, a lot of great work outside of the goose that sold for some pretty eye-popping numbers. I know there's a, you know, the Perfect Spectrum Squiggle sold for a little north of, I think it was like 600,000 or 625,000. There was a, you know, a number of Tyler Hobbs' work from Fidenza sold for some eye-popping numbers. So I guess the things that were most surprising were the strength at the high end of some of these collections. And we see this time and time again, these collection sets are not very large. But to see that enthusiasm continue at a time where I think there's a lot of questions around the work and the technology, and, you know, it's, I don't think I'm alone in saying that, you know, a lot of the people in our networks outside of this space have a lot of questions and wonder if this space will continue. And I think this was a huge day in demonstrating like there's real value that's being built here. And it was a pretty good example of I think everything that we all feel day to day.
Pete,
I feel like for me,
Amanda, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to mention, like, you know, for the sake of my bags, I want to say that I was actually probably the most bullish on this this Perfect Squiggle sale. I think, you know, this is a 10,000 piece collection, and that looks so simple, right? But I think it kind of speaks to the culture that has been created just around, number one, art blocks as a whole. I think the squiggle will always go down in history as the logo of art blocks and the beginning the beginning of it all, especially with the art blocks reign. And I think because there are 10,000 of them, you know, the fact that it's still possible to have a standout in that giant collection, it's still possible to have all of these different levels of, you know, what's a floor or what's a grail in a 10,000 piece collection, I think is huge, right? And there've been a lot of really high priced perfect spectrums. And I just think it's just a beautiful thing to see. And it makes me super bullish because it feels like this means that there's a lot more than just three whales moving around. If you have a 10,000 piece collection that stays really, really relevant, you have a lot of people who have a lot of love for the squiggle, and then hopefully, you know, other things in the future and in art in the future. So that was probably the one thing that stood out for me yesterday at the Sotheby's auction.
And for you, Amanda, it always comes back to your own bags.
Yes, always.
Pete, what struck you about yesterday?
I was really struck by, through all the chatter on Discord and Twitter and stuff, what really stood out was the artist's response to seeing their work on auction. Many of these artists, aside from, you know, Dimitri and Tyler and Eric, hadn't been on auction before. And I think there was like palpable excitement for them to like be elevated to this stage that they probably never certainly saw themselves being on this quickly, maybe ever. You know, this space created a lot of artists in the last 3 years that were maybe not considering themselves that prior to this. And I think it's really exciting to see this like creativity sort of blossom and this stage be opened up to them. And on the same note, we were talking about this earlier, but Matto, one of the Art Blocks artists, won one of the auctions, and he was saying that in the Discord. And I think that's like incredibly special to see an artist turn around and be able to bid on other peers' work that they admire and like be able to buy something at a Sotheby's auction. That's also something that probably never would have occurred other than this space. So stuff like that is just like really endearing to me. And I think although there's some criticism about maybe a lot of the sales having happened from within our community, I think that we need to like recognize the amazing things that this community has like offered to allow people to participate in this sort of thing that wouldn't have been available to them before.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can unpack that a little bit because it's been one of the primary themes, right, Pete? You know, great excitement at that big number, and of course for all of the knock-on effects of that sale. But one of the part of the conversation following that has been, you know, what does it mean that an existing buyer from our ecosystem and a well-known one at that, and of course a great steward of work in this space, was that collector, was that buyer, and that there wasn't some you know, magic traditional collector making their first big foray in. And what's your perspective there, Pete? Is like, is it good? Is it bad? It's probably neither, but how do you react to the fact that it wasn't an existing buyer?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, I mean, in this scenario specifically, I think it's really great because it shows like the amount of conviction that someone like 6529 and those within his fund like have like really had this whole time, but have like continued to evolve on. And I think that there's a steward specifically for a piece that is this significant, that has had such a strange short history, to carry on this torch. And I alluded to it earlier, but in his tweet, he mentions that, he was like one of two bidders that were in my DMs talking about this, like trying to buy the goose back in August of 2021. So and just got barely beat out because he was sort of bidding up to his limits of what his available ETH were. And it's like really exciting to see him just like basically put it all out there. And I think, you know, like they had so much conviction that they wanted to be the steward of this piece, and they wanted to sort of represent it in this like very specific way that they've been sort of ideating for the last couple of years, that it's really exciting. And also, like, I just thought, disillusioned enough to think that we're just going to get some magic buyers in here during this, like, you know, we're in the global markets are having a hard time, and like to imagine that there's going to be people that have like really fully wrapped their head around this thing and are going to go after some of these most sought after pieces within our cultural space, that seems like a sort of big hope for me, and I am not surprised that it didn't happen. But I'm also really encouraged to see, you know, these like little hints of more institutional adoption that are happening kind of all around us, and they're quiet, and I think they're going to act really quietly for a long time. But for example, this morning Michael Spalter tweeted about the Smithsonian Time-Based Media and Digital Art Working Group that they've recently rolled out. And there's a website just with all these resources, and that shows like real recognition that this like this legacy of what's been happening for almost a century in sort of computational art making is being recognized. And whether that happens financially in the near term from, you know, these more traditional people or not, I think that it's like, to me, that's just like a really strong sign that we're really all onto something. And it's exciting to sort of be in this like collective movement together at a global scale, which is also really interesting. I think art movements have happened historically, but generally they're sort of siloed into their, whatever their locations are, you know, and now we're like so hyper-connected that this thing is sort of happening. It's happening in real time with like the biggest community sort of connectivity that we've ever seen. And so I'm like very bullish on that.
Yeah. And as you were talking,
that's an interesting thought. Sorry, I was just going to say, that's an interesting phrase, time-based media. Is that in reference to the blockchain, or what is that in reference to?
Time-based media is like a common term for digital artworks, that like a video artwork is often referred to as time-based media.
Interesting.
Digital work that sort of All evolves right. over time, you know, uses time as the media. But it's been around
Got
for quite
it.
A while.
Cool.
Yeah, so Pete, as you were talking, I was showing some of those tweets of 6529 telling that story of being in the parking lot and working with you and VVD being on the other side of that. And so I think your take is spot on. I love it. It's like, he's the right buyer. It matters less whether it was an existing person in our ecosystem or fund in our ecosystem. And it matters that he's the right buyer and steward for this piece in particular. I think that's spot on. There is this other dimension of the goose. Now we're circling back to it, and the physical. And, you know, there's been this discussion that I've seen, and I can share a tweet in a moment, around over the long term, does the value of an artwork accrue mostly to, and I'm going to use a binary example, a one-of-one signed physical, and let's just use the goose, a one-of-one signed physical of the goose on the one hand, or the token that contains the pointer to the goose metadata, for example. And when those are unbundled, in this case, in fact, they're actually moving around together, and we can talk about that and your experience with that, Pete. But in a world where those are unbundled, where does value accrue over time? Maybe first, Pete, you can give people context specifically to this story, how that physical has moved around. And then maybe, Derek, I'll kick it to you to think about, you know, how those unbundling, what that means for value.
Yeah, sure. So I'll try to be brief about the sort of history of the physical and my experience with it. But and it's been, this has been a conversation like since the beginning of prints being made available via ArtBlocks projects. So I ordered the print, you know, and it took me a long time to order the print, actually, because I was like really pinching pennies. And I think at the time, ArtX Code was handling these beautiful prints and frames. And I just like was like kind of dragging on it. And I finally ordered it. It was just this incredible, you know, really beautifully produced print. And then when I sold the Goose to 3AC, I had reached, they had not mentioned it. They knew that it existed, you know, and I had reached out to them through VBD, Vincent Vando, saying, you know, I have the print and I'd love to like offer to send it to them if they want it. And they did. So the Goose went to Singapore. I've never sent a framed image to before, though I've sent quite a bit of like framed work before. So that was like a real trip. And then as this liquidation was happening and Sotheby's was named as the people that were going to be handling the sale, they had claimed at some point that they had the print. And I know that Dimitri was really cautious because he wanted to ensure that it was the real thing. And there was no evidence, you know, yet, I think, of how it had gotten to them or what the liquidators had captured. And I think eventually he even went over and met with Sotheby's and sort of looked at his signature and made sure it was real. So there was this sort of process of just being sure that whatever the claim is, that it's true. And it's this funny, it just goes back to this funny dynamic of how do we trace that thing if we're going to tie the two together? Is that scarcity, you know, it's not the same as the digital token, in my opinion, but like, what is the scarcity of it? What is the value of it? I'd love to hear what Derek has. I'm sure Derek has very thoughtful takes on this.
Yeah. I mean, so I love that story just because I think, again, it's just so, it's a very like emblematic of like some of the challenges and like the orthogonal ways that people are looking at this space and how value will accrete. I think my view is it really comes down to the artist's intent. And we now have a technology that can be used in all sorts of different directions. I think for many, they're using things like on-chain algorithms and ERC 721s that can reference those on-chain algorithms to create these outputs on the fly as the art. Like that is the art piece that they've created. The collection is, you know, exists purely on chain, and that's where they're hoping collectors and viewers can kind of spend time working through their work. There's other artists who I think, you know, are playing with the medium in a slightly different way, and they want, you know, the physicals maybe to be emblematic of a piece of the work or part of the work. I think one that comes to mind is Rip Cash, who in partnership with Transient Labs just created this drop called Public Private, where in order to gain access to the digital artwork, the collector had to scratch away the physical artwork in the area that contained the private key. And so it was this, you know, choice that the collector had to make in terms of like how they wanted to think about value. I think, you know, it also reminds me of some of the tension around this design space that we saw with the Damien Hirst piece, where collectors had to choose where value accreted. Was it, you know, keeping the token and burning the physical, or was it burning the token and keeping the physical? And so I don't know if there's one answer here. I think it really comes down, for me, I look to what is the artist's intent, what they are trying to say, how they're trying to play with this medium. And over time, I think we're going to see all sorts of exploration in this design space.
Yeah, I have a few other thoughts on this. I mean,
yeah, jump in, Pete. Yeah, please.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, well, I think you know, there's various ways of offering prints that coexist with digital. And I think Matt Delorier, who is another example of someone who's done it really interestingly, where he's offered prints to any holder. I think maybe in perpetuity, but I think there should probably be a cap to that, so he's not tied to having to, you know, make a print for somebody when he's 80. But something like this, where like the physical doesn't become so inherently connected to the digital and create these future problems when they're exchanging hands. And I think that's going to happen, as we've seen in the last 3 years, but down the line, I think these digital artifacts are going to change hands more frequently than physicals, just because of how easy that is. So to expect that a physical goes along with it is like a really challenging thing. So I like the sort of model that he uses. Else that we had mentioned in a chat the other day, Eli, is that, yeah, back to Michael Spalter, the Spalter collection had collected one of Daniel Calderon's Basque de Chapultepec pieces as a print and specifically not as the token, which I find really interesting. There was no sort of explanation because, of course, there's no responsibility for them to give an explanation, but it's interesting that it could sort of go the other way, that maybe certain pieces, people just want a print of a work on the wall and for whatever reasons, don't want the accompanying NFT. And what does that mean for the person who owns the NFT if it is a tokenized piece and not?
Yeah, I'll jump in super quickly. Just two things. The first is, I can't believe you pronounced that correctly. I love that DCA yeah. piece, but I can never get that right. The second thing I'll say is, and I think you said this very elegantly, Pete, which is like, it always reminds me too, like this is a public technology that anybody can interact with. And so I took the point of view that we should look at the artist's intent, but you're bringing up something really important, which is like, there will be collectors that want to interact with work in ways that are conducive to how they collect and how they think value should accrete. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think we're going to see both ends kind of play through this in real time. And I think that is, a reason why this space is so special. It offers up these questions that there aren't really great answers for. And because of like the neutrality of this technology, people can interact with it in any way that they'd like.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense, Derek. Sorry, I lost myself screen sharing for a moment. Amanda, from a collector perspective, I feel like I know that you're someone who gets hoodies made and you like to be able to live with the artwork that you collect. And I know you've gotten some physicals. Talk to us a little bit from your perspective. Like, why is it important to live with the work that you own and collect?
I mean, I just fall in love. Like, that's my problem. I'm like just uber bullish on everything. And the moment you get something printed, you now it feels like it's a part of you, right? I think I was talking to CT, one of our producers, who was saying like, now that she has, you know, a bunch of Squig related things, now it feels like she can't ever sell it because, you know, there is that sort of emotional tie to it. And I think it's true. I think that that's a good way to kind of make sure that you think twice if you're going to, you know, do something, especially if you want to keep it for yourself. I'm actually kind of, I'm not as big on prints as most folks would be, only because a lot of the things that I like, first of all, I love animated NFTs. And so I'm just waiting for the time and place for like actual screens to work really well. And then, you know, the way that I want to decorate my home is kind of different from the art that I love to see. And so I think digital art is what has really onboarded me to actually collecting art, because it can just stay on my phone or in my wallet, right? I can just look at it when I want, unless I had a really cool display in which I could just like sort of, you know, change every day or whatever at any moment that I wanted. But like getting it printed, putting it on my wall, it feels like you really have to kind of just save those for like the special moments. So, you know, obviously the Ringer, getting that printed and signed, like that's, you knew what you were doing there. Like that's a grail, right? But, you know, every kind of random NFT that you mint is not necessarily the best for prints. But yeah, that's what I feel.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point about the diversity of work. We're talking about one type of work that's perhaps quite well suited as a physical. Of course, there's such a diversity of multimedia and animated and otherwise audio-based works that demand other form factors that we haven't really solved yet very well. Amanda, to kick it back to you for a moment, anything on the community side, any questions on the auction or anything?
I had a couple questions actually that I thought were really good. I have one question on the auction, and then a couple of questions just about like Pete and what he does on the curation board, which I think would be really interesting. But if we were to stick to the auction, let's say this question comes from Wayne, one of our art collectors. He says, "What did the Sotheby's auction results tell us about the high end and the low end of the markets for these various collections? So, for Ringers in general, or for Squigs in general, Punks in general, what do we think? Yeah. Does that auction tell us anything about that?"
Hey, Derek, I'd be so curious if that's an opportunity to break power laws down. That this is a term I hear. I know Todd at Curated talks a lot about power laws. Do you think that's applicable here? And if yes, maybe you can distill it down for myself and others.
Yeah, I can try my best. I'd also love to hear from Pete. And just for context, I got two cute little dogs barking up a storm. So apologies if that's coming through. So it's a really interesting question. I think a few weeks ago when we were talking about this auction, I think I made the point that within our within crypto art, I think there's very much these de-risked collections. It's things like Ringers and Fidenza and Chromy Squiggle and Autoglyphs and CryptoPunks. And we see time and time again, there's just a support from collectors to come into these collections. And, you know, I like to think about things in terms of power laws. I think that's just the way the world works. Like liquidity begets liquidity, attention begets attention. And then within those power laws, those power law returns and those outcomes, I think there's additional set of power laws. And so this is where I think the Goose in particular as a singular object that's so well known and so well networked had the ability to result in, you know, the hammer price that we saw yesterday, because it is like, it sits within, you know, a very singular place as like this very well-known object inside of this very well-known collection by this very well-known artist. And so we see this time and time again, whether we're looking at traditional art or we're looking at, you know, the things people watch on television or the books people read or the names of culture that continue to persist. There are like these power law outcomes just all around us. And so I guess I say this to say, you know, it's important to keep an eye on these things and think critically about whether these trends are like ossifying into things that could represent these types of outcomes in the future. But then also what types of collections and objects maybe sit outside of that, that could one day be part of that, you know, that that same category. So I'll maybe tee it up for Pete, but that's just one framework that I think about when I think about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. I think that the Goose is just one of these anomalies that stands out not only in itself as a collection by an amazing artist, but also like it has like grown to almost represent art blocks in the way that squiggles represent art blocks, you know. And there's going to be these standouts that sort of rise above and sort of into a tier of their own. And you know, predicting value is really challenging. It's not something I'm particularly good at, I don't think, but I think that it is something that like those unique cases are something that's going to drive other collectors to buy the lower end. And you know, you want to be a part of the thing. And there's this thing in this world where we like are this collective voice that is like lifting up sort of this overall ecosystem and this type of artwork. So like if you own one squiggle out of 10,000, you are part of this whole, right? And just because yours costs like a fraction of the perfect spectrum doesn't mean that it's like not sort of part of that story and sort of helping to elevate the whole thing and sort of also helping to have like legs for a really long time and longevity as a piece of art and sort of in collectible and all those things sort of mashed together.
I just think that was brilliant, and I think covered some of the questions that you were asking, Eli. I think the thing that comes up for me, the thing that comes up for me is like there's this very like Veblen good status that comes with like the upper end of, you know, these markets. I guess I'm curious to hear from Pete and from you, Eli and Amanda. What do you think it looks like for other artists to start entering that category and for collectors? I think some of the criticism that I was kind of going through some of these threads this morning, some of the criticism from folks in our space is, you know, like we've identified some of these amazing artists who have created these amazing collections. And within those collections sit these really interesting, very highly collectible objects. What does it mean for collectors and for enthusiasm to start moving further out and identifying some of these new artists, these new collections, these new objects? What is it going to take? And I guess I would pose this question to you guys, like what do you think that looks like? And is that the right framework to be thinking about this stuff?
Pete, why don't you...
What does it look like?
Maybe Pete can sort of give us a closing thought here because of your experience on the... Well, as a long-term collector and on the Art Blocks curation board and advisor, you know, what are some of those dimensions, Pete, for you and when you're thinking about this?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think it's complicated because we are in a small ecosystem right now, you know, so there are not like a lot of newcomers. There's also not a lot of like new money coming in that's like providing the sort of opportunity for people that have been around for a while that aren't able to sort of sell things to collect their next thing, you know. that's one thing that we're up against. And I think it's just going to be time that is going to sort of start to heal that and to solve that. But something else that I think as Art Blocks mature specifically in relation to the curation board, my tastes have evolved a lot from just like highly graphic, really interesting work that is, you know, sort of technically interesting to work that is much more like I'm finding myself much more drawn to conceptual work. And I think a lot of us sort of discovered this maybe by happenstance through Human Unreadable. I think that was like this moment where all the things sort of came together in this like magical way. And like, there was this huge appreciation for it, for the people that have been criticizing the curation board for doing sort of overly conceptual work that wasn't like mass appealing. This project sort of combined the two in a way that I think allowed people to like, and Fake It Till You Make It did this to some sense too, but it allows people to think like in terms of conceptual art a little bit and go outside of their comfort zone and start to like think about art in a different way that doesn't have to be a pretty picture on the wall. So I think there is some like growth that will have to happen kind of naturally where if people are really in it for the art, you know, they will start to like, you know, their ideas will start to mature and their tastes will start to evolve. And sort of being open-minded to do that is part of this equation where like, you know, I think you have to sort of consider yourself as someone with an open mind to new things. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not really an answer to the question, but that's just sort of where my brain goes is that there's like a lot of ways to sort of like think about your own evolution into this thing. And I think that, you know, as there does become more adoption, like we will just like naturally have more people going into smaller projects and more artists having success. But there will be this disparity between the two just because of like the financial side of this whole thing.
It's such a well articulated and nuanced perspective, Pete. The only thing I would add in addition is that I think, you know, there's some sort of je ne sais quoi, or like, you know, there are certain moments like the naming of the goose, like that's not something you orchestrate or that you can identify before it happens. But if you're part of a moment and you can sort of see some of those signs of a thing happening, you know, maybe in some respects, that's sort of your most clear signal. If to your point, Pete, you're open to seeing those things and being a part of those communities and those conversations. We could probably talk about this stuff, not just the goose, not just the auction, not just generative art, for many hours. But I know, Pete, we want to be respectful of your time. It's been such a pleasure to have you on, man. Appreciate it. I'm sure it's been an interesting couple days. So we'd love to have you back in the future, man. Thank you.
Yeah, I would love that. Thanks for having me, guys. This is really, really great. I appreciate all the work you guys do.
You're the man, Pete. Let's go.
Let's go, Pete.
Thanks, Pete.
Amanda, you mentioned it at the top. Do you want to kick us into our Mythics Chronicle for the week?
Yes, I'm super excited. I saw a little clip of it yesterday. We are featuring a couple new people on the team. I think we've got Felix, our new director of ops. We got me in there for 1 second drinking, which is very par for the course, I guess, in this office. it's a great episode. We go down a little bit more about the masks of Mythics, and I think it'll be a lot of fun for people to see kind of how crazy they go. You guys, I think, have seen just like some chill ones so far. So check it out.
Kevin, are you okay with me filming?
I mean, it's Friday, right?
Yeah.
Friday. Awesome. Thank you.
What are you drawing today, Colin?
Today is crocodile mask. Who knows? It's a bit weird, you know? Like seeing a bird in a croc mask.
Also doubles as like a warrior mask when fighting the dread.
Who is the dread? What is dread? It's our version of FUD.
And he eats little birds.
I have been reading this like Batman series about the Court of Owls, and so I had created these masks because you'd wear them to go to Parliament. Kevin really hated the idea, really squandered the creativity that could have been
back to the original file, at least some of the stuff that got cut, you will know why.
tubing.
Payment for services.
Well, the mythics are their ancestors. They like the traditional way. They have, they're a little more magic infused and kind of like from the past compared to moonbirds. We decided to kind of design a faction within the mythics who are like, no, no, we don't like the super old stuff. We're actually still futuristic and make a, what we're calling a glitch mask. So it's kind of this, this is just a concept of it.
Cheers. Are you bringing this to my hot box? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. These are the types of tasks that really drive my ADD like wild, where it feels like there's just a hurricane like about to rupture inside of me.
I think there's a lot of flexibility that we can really take in kind of exploring what the world looks like, even when it's obfuscating. You can't really see the like owl shape beneath it. You can tell, I think, based on the style that it's created in and some of the color palettes and just the way it's kind of oriented, like this is part of that Mythics collection. And that's a freedom that we didn't really get as much in the Moonbirds, which I think is really fun.
You know, maybe they're, this is just a agents of chaos in the world. Like they don't necessarily side with the Dread. They, maybe they haven't fallen to despair and they're not pushing with the Moonbirds and the Mythics to ascend. They're kind of somewhere in between. So I call this like a trickster faction where they're still kind of like enjoying technology and rejecting the return of the Mythics a little bit.
With the Mythics, we're going a little crazy over here, and we drew a ton of different masks.
And we really wanted a reason to have a Moonbird Eyes Wide Shut part.
Yeah, yeah. There's a Moonbirds is an 18 plus collection, which we've been very adamant about from the very beginning.
All right, here's a question. How many proofers does it take?
There we go.
To get some tape going. Someone was stop.
Amazing. I can't believe Mal left that 18 plus joke in there. We're showing a little, we're getting a little spicy here with these chronicles. Great job. Once again, Mao crushed it. The response in the community, everyone is still talking about my fanny pack joke, which I love. You know, everyone is just talking about how, you know, limited edition, there'll be in a couple of years. So I love that. I mean, you guys knocked it out of the park again. I'm going to wait. I think everyone is still kind of enjoying it, but they love it, of course. And shout out to Felix. Shout out to Colin.
Yeah, I love these. You know, this is something Mao and I talked about a little while ago. It's like, it's to me, when I look at other projects or products, it's like, I want to know what it's like behind the scenes. I want to be a part mm-hmm. of the creation process. And so it's fun to be able to see the characters that we happen to have on our team as they build what I think is going to be a really special collection, ultimately, with Mythics. So we have, and we tease it at the top, we have now an artist spotlight that we're going to kick to with the amazing artist, James Jean. So James was in Rail season 2, of course, but is, you know, really one of the most well-respected artists in the space and beyond. He has a huge body of work outside of NFTs as well, of course. You know, the most fun part for me was being able to go to the studio with a small team, and Mao and Amanda were there, and have him walk us through these different parts of his practice. So this is about a 10-minute studio tour. It's quite rare that James brings people into his space, so we're very honored and grateful. Let's kick into that now. We had the opportunity to go visit James Jean, the amazing artist in person.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, really excited. This is amazing.
Yeah, let's take a tour.
We brought a small team there and we got to go behind the scenes, see his process, see early sketches of some of the works you all know so well. When we arrived, James took us through three of his most well-known and recent movie posters, and we got to see the very first sketches. And immediately, you can just see the talent and the thoughtfulness and the level of detail that comes through in James's work.
I know a lot of artists kind of frown on doing commercial work, but I like doing certain projects that I think engage with broader audiences, yeah, especially with the movie posters.
Yes.
And it's great to like work directly with these directors I really respect and admire, and they reach out to me directly, and this past year just so happened that three of the movies I worked on all won Oscars, so
amazing.
It's kind of crazy.
What's your process with something like this, James? It's where do you start, I guess?
Sure. Actually, I have a sketch over there. You can take a look. Yeah. So yeah, it just starts with the
wow
sketch and
oh wow, yeah,
working directly with Guillermo, he actually just wrote like a little paragraph about Pinocchio and what it meant to him. And he was talking about how Pinocchio was about the dance of creation between a father and his son, and so that inspired the idea for this composition.
Amazing.
And so the idea that Pinocchio is kind of stepping out the frame, trying to venture out into the world on his own. And now it's displayed at MoMA because they have a show there for Pinocchio.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then MoMA acquired the poster for their collection. So
that's so cool.
Yeah.
And then was this the first?
Yeah, this was the first sketch for Everything Everywhere
wow
at once. So you can see it's quite rough, just kind of like mapping everything out.
Yeah.
And there's like two versions of Michelle Yeoh here. And this poster was different from Pinocchio in that it was drawn on the iPad. So, the iPad using Procreate allows me to get into a lot more detail.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this is just the pure line drawing. Wow. So, all the details of the wheelchair and all the electronic elements,
this is so impressive.
It's a crazy piece. I mean, it drove me. Insane. Yeah. And with the whale, it was much more simple of a project where I just had wanted to focus in on his portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Darren, hey, can I pull in these influences from like Lucian Freud, and there's another artist, Kiki Smith, and can I just do like a very simple portrait? And this was done in ink. And also finished in Photoshop.
Mm-hmm. So it's something like this. You decide to, you didn't go with the full face.
No, I want to crop in and get a sense of like the skin kind of feeling expansive and like, infinite.
That's so good.
Yeah. It's sort of like the face, the features, resembling like a topology or map of a landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that excess skin creating.
Exactly.
James took us then upstairs in his studio where he had set up a beautiful sculpture at the top of the stairs.
So this is based off of an old painting I'd done in 2008. And it's a recurring character.
And is that true of many of the characters? They
originate. Yeah, they originate as characters in a flat illustration or painting, and then I bring them to life. So in the painting, you actually see her from behind.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even know what her face looks like. So with the sculpture, it's great to be able to create something that kind of continues the narrative, get a sense of her expression.
And does a character like this emanate from some either individual in your life or an amalgam of people, or it's less connected to your reality?
No, I think they're from another reality.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, they're never like specific portraits. Yeah. So the people say like the descendant character and Slingshot kind of resembles my son. But I made the Slingshot before he was even born.
Yeah,
I don't know. But I'm sure there's some influence somewhere. But
yeah.
They're kind of meant to be more universal.
And we also got to see four or five physicals that relate back to his body of work called Adrift.
These are from Adrift, our first iteration. So I'm going to be updating these. We're going to approach it a little differently, but this is my first try at it.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah. So I made these prints for an event I did with Outland at Bridge House, my architect's house in Hancock mm-hmm. Park.
So. Oh, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is a collection that you'll draw ultimately with Outland yeah. And pretty large.
Yeah.
Pretty large.
Well, yeah, we're thinking maybe around 5,000
yeah.
or so.
Yeah.
As we walked into the room adjacent to the hallway, on the wall in the bedroom, so to speak, James showed us this amazing tapestry created by these amazing wool fabrics, incredibly detailed.
Yeah, it's all done in shallow relief, carved out of New Zealand wool. Mm. So it's an edition of 3 with 2 APs. So this is my AP.
Amazing. Yeah.
With the tiger rug, I designed it specifically to be the rug so I could play with the silhouette of it. And then we're doing another one for You're the Rabbit. And that's, I think there's some samples downstairs hanging on the wall.
James also had some infinite objects, and he had a digital display on the wall showing a work that's being currently displayed at one of the top museums in the world.
And the this is just a sample that Infinite Objects did for us. Yeah, so we're showing this specific animation at the museum shows right now.
Mm. And when you do it at the museums, what's the form factor?
We make like these giant, like 10, 12 foot tall screens.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're these huge like monuments that are animated, which is pretty cool. And this one is also being shown at the museum too.
Mm. And then James took us back into the hallway, and we went into a secondary bedroom where there were 3 very large, incredibly detailed commissioned works.
These are fantastic.
Yeah. But these are all commissions except for the one behind you. This one I just finished a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be going off to Korea for an art fair.
So this is... a little bit of a departure in terms of palette and color.
Yeah, I wanted to do something more monochromatic. I like bouncing between different approaches. So, you know, like this approach is like very precise and there's a lot of colors. It's very graphic. And I wanted to, I think, return to an earlier way of painting where it was maybe softer and more direct. You know, I like the monochromatic approach because it allows me to develop the painting very quickly without like worrying about mixing all the different colors that go into these.
And when you're working on something like this, does it start from a feeling like there was something you wanted to express broad, like specifically to this character or yourself? Or
I think this piece is about anxiety and all the different, you know, competing thoughts, intrusive thoughts that can happen in your internal world. This one's going to a music producer in Korea.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a jam session.
So yeah. Good. Yes.
I love that one.
Oh, yeah. That's part of the Adrift series. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think that's a cool one. Yeah, out of the whole group, I like this one the most. Yeah, it's like coral reef
character.
We got an opportunity to really go deep on each of those 3. And then we went downstairs and James showed us the dome structures that he's been working on that relate back to his project Fragments.
This is the stained glass dome I've been working on for the past 3 years with Justin Studios in Pasadena. And so the Fragments collection was inspired by this project.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's about a little over 7,000 pieces of glass that are required to make this structure.
Oh,
so that correlated to, you know, the amount of NFTs that you know, most collections were at around that time. And so I thought it was like a perfect kind of way to make a relationship between the two. And so, so you can see the shape here of the pentagon is the shape of all the fragments.
And was this the earliest?
Yeah, that's the first one.
Amazing.
And then I made a more refined drawing here, which I scanned into the computer and then started coloring. And now we have a sample over there by the window.
Well, oh, wow.
And then ultimately, James showed us this amazing stained glass, or really a version of a stained glass piece that will ultimately form a full-size dome with this intricate illustration and design on its exterior.
Yeah, we've developed a new process of making stained glass. So traditional stained glass has lead lines, and we've eliminated all the lead lines And then also traditional stained glass, the gradients and also the line work is painted on top. But I didn't like the effect of the line work kind of sitting on the surface. I wanted the lines and the gradients to be embedded in the glass. So we used digital workflow and also water jet cutter to kind of figure out how to integrate the line work into the glass, or basically turn the line work into glass and fuse it all together. But there's like custom scripting actually to figure out how to make these gradients. So this is called frit, which is like a particulate glass that you just kind of sift out in various proportions, and then it's put in the kiln and melted, and that's how you get this fade.
Lastly, James took us into the garage in his studio where he was working on an immense, very large scale piece.
Oh, wow. This is another commission, James?
Yeah. Yeah, so this was about halfway done. I have to go in and finish all the rendering, the gradients, add texture, and then I have to go in and redo all the line work and shading and everything. Mm. But the base of it is there. Yeah, you can see the sketch.
Oh, there's something, the color studies are so fascinating, just as an artifact. I love those.
Yeah, we actually just got these back from my Shanghai show.
Oh, wow.
So some of these were some of the massive paintings I did for my show, Eternal Journey in Korea.
Wow.
We also got to see the way that he dials in the color and really does this color study, this color matching when he goes from the digital to the physical.
Yeah, it's really cool to see like all the marks from history of making the painting. Yeah, trying to match the background color.
Mm-hmm. And so we got to see the way that process occurs. He had out on the table in the garage a number of versions of that color study and color mapping that he and his team ultimately do, see everything that I mentioned, and ultimately see these books that he's produced.
And these are all...
Oh, these are my past books. Yeah, publications. So this is the most recent one that'll be coming out soon.
Mm.
This is a catalog from the Eternal Spiral Museum show. And then this one was for BTS. I did a collaboration show with BTS. Wow. Yeah, each painting's based on a member of the band.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. And it refers to, each one's unique story or characteristic. And
that's my new life goal, is to have you, James, interpret me in...
As a K-pop star.
Yeah, and also that, yeah.
And so really being able to move around James's space was really a fascinating journey, and a beautiful morning spent with James, and incredibly gracious of him to bring us into his space. Okay, what did you guys think? Derek, Amanda... for me, it was such a joy to watch that back for the first time. Mao, as always, does such a great job.
Yeah, man, I thought
that was so much fun.
No, go for it, Amanda. I want to hear your take.
Look, that was so much fun. You were just like, does anyone want to go to the James Jean studio with me? I'm going to be in town. I'm going to go hang out. And I was like, yeah, I would love to go to his studio. And I think that was probably the first time, at least in my memory, that I'd ever been to an artist studio. And it was just beautiful. I mean, when we're talking about like physicals, the man does physicals probably the best of any artist I've ever seen. Everything that he does, his sculptures and his prints are always like the highest qualities. So that was just really cool to get some cool ideas for the future, just because everything at his studio was like a killer. And yes, I was wearing the fanny pack. I also just wanted to mention that because I wear it everywhere I go. The fanny pack is life. So there's that. No, but that was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for bringing us along.
Yeah, it looked like an awesome time. I also just want to like kudos to the Proof team for continuing to storytell these trips and these experiences and these artists in such a compelling way. It's fun outside looking in at these little experiences that you guys are curating and showcasing. So keep up the good work there, because I've been enjoying all of them.
I appreciate that, man. And now that we have this physical space, I'm already imagining the way we can take people behind the scenes and have artists in that space creating and let people both in person experience that creation and also through some of this storytelling that Mao and his team do so effectively, right?
Yeah.
All right, this has been a good one. This has been a good show. Another week in Web3, crypto, NFTs. It is never boring. This was a big week though. And I think we'll look back on yesterday for some time as marking a moment, at least in sort of the generative art side of what we're doing here, as being quite momentous. I think Pete's still around. Pete, we could not
Let's
get rid
go.
Of Pete. He's still here. Man, Pete's welcome to hang out anytime.
I love that
Pete,
guy.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you, guys. It was awesome. I stuck around for the video. That was such an awesome studio tour. So thanks for putting that together.
Thanks, man. All right. We will be back, as always, next Friday. This is 100 Proof. See you guys. Thank you.
Thanks, gang.
See ya.